So this evening, we launch into the third chapter of Tanya. And this chapter is a part of the first section of Tanya. Tanya is very well structured. And the first nine chapters are really giving us the building blocks of our own personality. Before, Tanya wants to tell us about our mission in this world and how we can achieve it, what we're here for, what our challenge is, and to do that, you need to know what you've got. You need to know what you're made of. What are the tools you've been given to fulfill that mission? Before you can know what you need to do, you have to know who you are. And with that, we can then figure out what we're here for. So we've already learned in the first two chapters, the first, I guess, bombshell that really Tanya has landed on us, and that is that we've got two souls. We always knew we have a soul, but that we have two, for most of us, that's news. Unless you're familiar with the Kabbalistic writings, as Rabbi Shneur Zalman was, and even if you were, you may not have noticed this idea that there are two souls, the animalistic soul and the divine soul, which we've discussed and we're going to hear more about. But that's the foundation, the first lesson of Tanya. And now in chapter three, we're going to go into more detail as to how those souls experience or express themselves within our personality. And most specifically in this chapter, we're going to learn about the 10 sphirot, the 10 emanations as they're called, which are 10 personality traits or characteristics of our personality and how they work within us. So let's have a look in Tanya chapter 3. We'll look here in the translation. Now, each distinction and grade of the three, nefesh, ruach, and neshama, consists of 10 faculties. The three, because we did say in the early chapters that our soul is divided up into three levels, nefesh, ruach, and neshama. There are more than that. There are varying different levels, but in general, those three. Each of those three consists of 10 faculties. There are 10 faculties of the soul. Whatever soul level we're talking about, whatever soul level a person is on, you have 10 faculties within your soul. And we're going to get to know what they are. These 10 faculties correspond to the supernal 10 sphirot, or divine manifestations, from which they have descended. Now, Tanya here is assuming a certain Kabbalistic knowledge and something that some of us may have heard of, the idea of ten sefirot, that God in creating the universe took on a persona, as it were, faculties of a personality in order to interact with the world. We're not going to go into this too deeply, but just to scratch the surface. God is one. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. When we say God is one, what we mean by that is not just there's one God and not many gods. That's of course true. But we mean much more than that. That God is a oneness. God is indivisible. God is not a being that has bits and parts and sections and levels. God is a pure oneness. Because he is infinite, and because he's infinite means no definition, beyond any definition. So there's no description that you can make of him because he's not a composite of parts. So therefore he's in absolute oneness. Unlike everything else in the universe, it's made up of stuff. We spoke about the four elements in the first chapter that make up everything in the universe. Everything has its bits and pieces put together. You and I have a lot of different faculties and bits and pieces to ourselves. God is one. He's an absolute oneness. However, because God wanted to interact with us, and we are finite beings with personalities, with various faculties, God took on, as it were, he adopted a personality, which the Kabbalists call the 10 sphirot. 10 different faculties, abilities, expressions of himself. It's not that he is 10 or divided by 10. not that they're parts or bits of him that you could take apart, but he took on that persona in order to interact with us. Almost like an adult that wants to interact with their child, so that adult takes on a bit of a child personality. And you get interested in the Lego and in the games and in what the child is doing. You take that on because you want to relate to the child. Maybe you wouldn't be playing that game on your own, but if you want to relate to the child, you take it on. So too, God wants to relate to us. So he took on a finite personality, as it were, in order that we can react and interact with him. And these are called the ten sefirot. It's a much broader topic than that, deserving of more. But for the purposes of our discussion, God took on those ten sefirot and then created us in his image. In order for there to be an interaction, the ability to interact, he took on a personality, then he created us with that personality. Everything in his reality is reflected in our reality. And this is quite a revolutionary thought, because this means that we, by observing the human reality, we can extrapolate something about the divine. And by studying the divine reality, we can get a deeper understanding of the human being, because we're created in his image, the image that he took on. So even though we can't understand God's essence, because that's oneness, that's beyond, but the personality he took on, we can get a bit of an inkling of a grapple of that, some type of sense of it, because we're in that image. More specifically here, it says that God took on 10 faculties and created us in his image with those 10 faculties. The human being has them as well. What are these 10 faculties? So he continues on the third line. These are subdivided into two general categories. The 10 are subdivided into two, namely the 3 mothers and the 7 multiples. We would call them, in human experience, and we'll see in the next paragraph, there's 3 intellectual faculties and 7 emotional faculties. The intellectual faculties are described here as mothers, the emotional faculties as multiples, or kfulot, which is like doubles. And we're going to explain in depth what all that means. To wit, and what are these faculties? Chachma is the first one, which translates as wisdom. Bina, understanding. And Daat, knowledge. The 3 intellectual faculties. And the 7 days of creation, meaning 7 faculties that correspond to the 7 days of creation. Chesed, which is kindness. Gvura, which is power. Tiferet, which is beauty. And so on. He doesn't list the next 4. At the moment, this is just Kabbalistic terminology. We're not being explained anything, but we'll keep reading and then we're going to understand it. Second paragraph. Similarly, is it within the human soul, which is divided into 2. Seichel, intellect, and midot, emotional attributes. The intellect includes Chachma, Bina, and Daat, the acronym of which is Chabad. Whilst the midot are love of God, dread and awe of him, glorification of him, and so forth. Chabad, the intellectual faculties, are called mothers and source of the midot, for the latter are offspring of the former. All right. Because we've got this amazing gift of being created in God's image, so to understand this Kabbalistic stuff, we actually can. Because you know yourself to some extent, and by understanding and observing yourself and the way you work, you can understand a bit about the divine. And so these Kabbalistic terms will become familiar to us. That God took on these 10 faculties, and he gave us those 10 faculties. They're divided into 2 subcategories, the 3 intellectual faculties and the 7 emotional faculties. The world was created in 7 days, and the week is a 7-day week. I don't know if you ever noticed, but the week is the only thing in our calendar that has no astronomical base to it. There's no reason why there should be 7 days in the week. The reason why we have a month is a lunar cycle. The reason we have a day is the interrelation between the Earth and the Sun is a 24-hour period. A year is the full cycle of the Sun. So that's a solar thing. The year is solar, the month is lunar. The day is a solar thing. A week? Why are there 7 days in the week?
It's good to compartments.
It makes it easier. Imagine it'd be a month. That would be you work and have the end of the month off, you know, like that wouldn't work. How we have to compartment. But where's seven? Where did seven come from? And why is that something that is quite universal? Not completely. There are cultures that have different ways of counting time. But the seven-day week is one that is pretty widespread. Where did it come from? There's no sign in the sky of 7 days. From creation. The world was created in 6 days and God rested on the seventh. It started that way.
So was there no subdivision less than a month prior to...
No, that was creation. That's all the way from creation. All the way from the beginning. There was a seven-day week.
But before Jews became Jews, did other cultures have that subdivision?
The creation, Adam and Eve had it. Shabbos is from all
so
the way
no
back then.
No, any different than...
Yep. And why is there a seven-day week? Because God took on seven emotional faculties. And the definition of an emotion is the way I interact and respond to somebody outside of me. My intellect is what's going on inside of me. My emotions are the way I'm interacting with the outside world. Intellect is taking in information, but emotion is bringing out and having a relationship. And so creation... God has 10 faculties, but the 3 intellectual faculties are beyond creation. The 7 emotional faculties are expressed in creation. So the world was created in 7 days. And that's the reason why 7 is a number. That's why it's a thing.
Do they relate to any certain day at all?
Yeah. So Sunday was the day of chesed, of kindness. And Monday was of gvura. And... we can go through creation, the creation story, and see how the creations of each day correspond to those faculties, if we had time. Maybe another time we could do that. So that's where that's in the divine creation, that's how it works. That's then reflected in us, 3 intellectual faculties and 7 emotional faculties.
The faculties existed before man.
Correct. So God took on those 7 faculties, the 3 and the 7, created the world in the 7 days expressing those 7 faculties and created the human being in his image with these 10 faculties as well.
Chesed existed with God and then brought down Chesed.
Correct.
But then he only brought down the man once man was created because Chesed existed pre-man.
Correct. But interestingly, it's explained in Chassidus that these 10 faculties, it's because God wanted to make man that he took on these faculties in the first place. Because the entire creation is not for the universe, it's for the human being that can have a relationship with God. And so him taking on these 10 faculties was because I want to make a person, and I want that person to have intellect and emotion, so I'm going to have that as well. It's the creating us in his image is a bit circular. He took on that image because he wanted to create us. The reason why man was created last was not because we were like the afterthought or whatever, you know, might as well do that as well. It was the whole point of creation was the human being. That's why some argue that woman was even after man, you know, so... the real pinnacle of creation is woman.
Well, we thought the human soul was purely emotion. It's intellect as well.
100%. Yes. And we're going to see how important the intellect is in the soul. Because here, the intellect is called a mother, and emotions are called the offspring of the mother.
So when you say the human soul, you mean the, not the animal soul?
Well, both animal and divine soul have all of these faculties. They're created in a sort of a mirror image to each other, that both animal and divine soul have intellect and have emotion. But as we'll see, they're very different. The animal soul's intellect is very different to the divine soul's intellect, and so to the emotions. Here we're starting off describing more the divine soul structure, but the animal soul has a similar structure, but works differently. The main difference is the divine soul, the intellect, gives birth to emotion and directs the emotion. In the animal soul, the emotion rules and intellect follows. And we'll see why.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So you've got your godly soul and your animal soul, and then each of those souls has a nefesh, ruach, and neshama.
Yes.
And then each of those nefesh, ruach, and neshama all got 10 spheres.
Correct. And so at any one time, you are operating either from your animal side or you from your divine side. And in each one of those, from either your nefesh, ruach, and neshama level. So each one, it's like a matrix where each one has is subdivided into subcategories. Now, let's just examine these last words that we read, that the intellect is the mother that gives birth to the offspring, which is the emotions. What he means by that is, we wouldn't necessarily think that what that's saying is true. We don't feel that our intellect gives birth to our emotions. On the contrary, our emotions seem quite far from our intellect. We have a feeling for something, or instinctive feeling, that it doesn't seem anywhere near coming from our intellect. They're quite opposite. If we just understand, intellect is that part of us which is objective, removed. We can judge and see things from a distance, see things for what they are. Emotion is subjective, involved, passionate. Intellect views it from a distance, whereas emotion is, I'm involved now, I'm in it. And it seems that emotions have a source of their own. We sometimes don't even understand our own emotions. Why am I so scared of this? Why do I love this person so much? Why does this excite me? And why does that repel me? Like, why am I into this and not into that? Like, we don't always understand why. So how do we see that an intellect is giving birth to emotions? It seems that our emotions do their thing, our intellect does its thing. Very often they're at loggerheads. We know something is wrong, but we still want it. We have a desire for it. Our emotions are attracted to something, even if our head tells us that's bad news. Or our mind says, I should want this, and our heart is not in it. So where's this relation between intellect and emotion? It seems in most of our experience, they're two very different worlds. What the Alter Rebbe here is teaching us is that even though, yes, there can be conflict between intellect and emotion, and much of our lives we spend that way, you cannot have an emotion without intellect pointing towards that emotion. Because quite simply, you cannot have a feeling about something or towards something that you're not aware of at all. It has to first start with awareness, which is intellect. You have to have some intellectual awareness of the existence of something and what it is and its description, and that will point the emotion either towards it with love or away from it with fear, whatever it may be, but it starts with intellect. Let's look at a few examples to understand this. Let's look at people first of all. There are people that we love and people that not necessarily we feel that emotion towards. Why? Well, first, obviously, you have to know that person. You can't love somebody that you've never met, never heard of, and don't know they exist. You can't feel love towards somebody that there's no awareness of whatsoever. You have to have some awareness of that person. But more than that, there has to be some description of that person that causes you to love them. The description may be an accurate one or inaccurate one, but there must be something that causes to love. So if you're introduced to somebody for the very first time, and you just have a 5 minute chat, you're already going to have some type of judgment about that person. Naturally, that's how we are. My type, not my type. Like them, not like them. Interested, not interested. Based on that 5 minute conversation, whatever information you got there in your mind is going to cause something, maybe strong, maybe weak, but there'll be some type of feeling towards them. You can't have a feeling without some information. It may be inaccurate. We make very quick decisions sometimes that are based on very little evidence. But whatever evidence that was, it will cause either a feeling towards or a feeling against. And we think that it's coming from a deep place sometimes. Not necessarily. It can be coming from a very superficial place. So, for example, you met somebody and they reminded you of somebody else. You know, our mind always makes associations. So maybe the way they looked, their voice, their name, their smell, something they said, it reminds you of somebody else. And that's somebody else you like. So you like this person. I have a good feeling about that person. Based on what? Because they reminded you of somebody else? You're not even aware that that's what's going on in your mind, but your brain is making that connection and you have a feeling towards that person. If they remind you of somebody who you don't like so much, you also, I don't have a good feeling about this person. And you think this is a feeling, this is my intuition. It's not intuition. It's a quick judgment that your mind is making through an association that you've made, which may or may not be accurate. As you get to know a person better, you have more information, so that feeling may change. I had a bad impression at first. I get to know the person and I realize that association I made unconsciously is so off because they're nothing like that other person that I was associating with without even realizing it. And I get to like that person. And my feelings change towards that person. How does the feeling change? But with more information. So it's based, the way my mind defines this person will be that my emotions towards them. And I'm aware of some of that and not aware of some of it. I have prejudices in my head. There are things that you know, people with blonde hair are like that. And people with black hair are like this. I don't even realize I think that way, but I think that way. And so my mind is telling me good or bad. But it's information in my brain. It's attitudes that I have in my brain that is where it all begins, and then it goes down to an emotion.
Wouldn't cerebral be a better description than intellect? Because you're not describing intellect as we would define intellect. You're defining a decision-making process, which isn't necessarily, I would have thought, related to intellect.
Well, It's seichel in Hebrew. Seichel means that which is going on in the brain. Emotion is what's going on in the heart. Now, I know emotions go on in the brain, but from a Hasidic perspective, they're noted in the brain, but they're happening in the heart. Our heart beats faster with excitement. It's a more palpable part of our body as opposed to the part of our brain that's a bit more removed from the body. So yeah, you could use cerebral as a better word. Seichel is the general term here that we're using. It means information as opposed to emotion.
Isn't seichel commonly translated as common sense?
That's mean use your seichel means use your brain. Like so we use but seichel means intellect. There's also bad intellect or irrational intellect, you know, silly thoughts, but it's all in the brain. So we also see this in the way we develop as people from our younger years as we get older. The things we get excited and passionate about change as we get older. The things we're scared of change as we get older. So a little child is scared of the dark. Why? What's scary about the dark? Well, you don't know. There's unknowns. You know, there could be a monster under the bed. I don't know what's happening. So for a child, it's scary. They can't verbalize that. You can't ask a child, "What are you scared of?" It's dark. I want the light on. It's scary. Why? What? They can't rationalize their fear because they're a little kid. But for a little kid, dark is scary. For an adult, you know that just because it's dark doesn't mean there's a monster under the bed. Like, that, it doesn't work that way. You've developed that mindset. You have other fears. You might be scared of public speaking, even though you're older. Why? What are you scared of? You get up and you talk. What's the big deal? I'm scared of it. That's my fear. That's what I'm scared. I'm scared I'll make a fool of myself. I'm scared. Our fears mature and develop. That little kid who's scared of the dark might not have any problem getting up in front of a crowd and speaking. They're not scared of that. They're also not scared of jumping off a wall, which is a bit scary for an adult, but for a kid, what could go wrong? So our perception of the world, our understanding of it in our mind, in our intellect, as we develop, it changes our emotions, what we're scared of, and what we're excited about. A little kid is excited about an ice cream. And that's better than anything, because that's his understanding. If you offer a little kid, a two-year-old, ice cream or a $50 note, what do you prefer? A two-year-old will go for the ice cream, because they haven't developed the understanding that $50 can buy you 20 ice creams. They haven't developed that understanding yet, so they're excited about this and not that. It's all understanding. It's all the way you perceive. So what you define in your mind as good, you're attracted to and excited by. That's the emotion of love. What you in your mind define as bad, you're scared of. That's the emotion of gevura, of retreat, of recoiling from, of fear. It's all up to your mind's definitions. And if your mind can be changed, your emotion can be changed. If you can change your perception of something, your feelings towards it can be changed. If I tell you to start liking somebody that you don't like, say, just like them, but I don't like them. So start liking them. I don't like them. You can't just like someone you don't like. That's true. But if I sit down and say, I think you've misjudged this person. I think you haven't got to know this person correctly. I don't think you know who this person is. And if I can reveal to you elements to their personality or their story that you weren't aware of and you didn't know, then you might be able to stop and say, well, if my mind can be convinced that what you're saying is true, if I can see evidence of it, if I can see that that's really the case, my feelings can change towards that person. And so to the opposite as well. You find out something about somebody that you didn't know and they're not your friend anymore. what happened? Emotions change. Feelings change. I can't change a feeling head on. I can't tell you to change a feeling. But I can change your mind. And you can change your mind. And that will change feelings. So in that way, the human being has this incredible power that we don't always realize we have. We often think that our feelings are fixed. That's the way I feel. That's it. About anything. About my job. About my sister-in-law. About the person I'm working with. My neighbor. Myself. My life, all these things, I have like certain feelings about it. I'm happy, I'm not happy. It's good, it's not good. I like this one, I don't like that one. We feel that's quite fixed, and it feels very fixed because someone can't just tell me, feel good about it. Feel good about life. Don't feel bad, feel good. But I feel bad. Like this person, but I don't. If you try to hit the feeling, feelings don't have perspective. Feelings don't have any objective view. What I feel is what I feel, and that's it. That's true. But what you think is different to what you feel. Thinking, our power of intellect is, I have an opinion. You have an opinion. I can hear your opinion with my mind, and I could take it on. I could take on the information that you have, the view that you have, which is different to mine, and it could change my mind. Your feelings can't change my feelings, but your mind can change my mind. Information can make me see things differently. And through that, my emotions can change.
Is it right to say that our intellect is something about thinking slower, taking time to process it, and our emotions are automatic and just live there, and we're trying to use the time to change the emotions, which are automatic and quick?
Yes, yep. The thinking fast, thinking slow thing. Yes, it definitely is. It does fit into that. That the mind, within the mind, we also have those two faculties, and we'll see that Chachma and Bina, which we're about to describe, Chachma is a quick judgment, Bina is a slow development of an idea, and if we go straight from the quick judgment to emotions, so then we make knee-jerk decisions and reactions, which sometimes are right and sometimes not. When we think through things, we're more likely to get to a better picture, as long as the thinking through stays true to the facts and we don't meander too much. So we'll see that the thinking fast and thinking slow does certainly fit in here. So if I'm not happy with my life at the moment, I can't just become happy just like that. But I could look at it differently. I could stop and say, well, what am I not happy with? And why is it happening? And is it possible that there's a higher purpose? And maybe what I'm not happy about is God has put me in this position to be challenged by this situation that I'm in now, to develop and grow and to find some light in the particular darkness that I'm feeling at the moment. And if there's meaning, if I can find meaning in the thing that I'm not enjoying, well, maybe I can rise above that and say, well, this is not bad. Why define it as bad? I'm not enjoying it, but maybe I can find a deeper purpose in it. Or a person that I'm not getting on with and I don't particularly like. But if it's my sister-in-law or my work colleague, and I've got to work with these people, they're a part of my family or my team or whatever it is, so then maybe I can change my perspective. And instead of defining that person as just bad and annoying and obnoxious, maybe they're troubled. Maybe what I'm seeing is true, but like if I define it differently in my mind, and I say, well, I was put into this position to maybe bring some light and some love and change it around. Turn it around and not look at them with disdain, but like look at them with a bit of pity and love and compassion. And then my mind can change the feeling. This is why the Alter Rebbe called his philosophy Chabad. Because Chabad is the acronym for Chochma Bina Daat, the three intellectual faculties which we're about to get to know very deeply. The intellectual faculties is the key. Not because intellect and the mind is the most important thing. In many ways, emotions are more important than intellect, because emotion is really you. The way you feel, what you love and what you hate and fear, that's really much more you. That's your midot. Midot is your personality. Much more than your intellect. What's the saying that people don't care what you know until they know that you care? Something like that. That what you know in your head, it's information. What you care about, that's much more you. So midot are more important than intellect. However, intellect is the key. Because I can't talk to your emotions, but I can talk to your mind. I can't change your feelings, but I can change your perspective. When I'm working on myself, I can't say, okay, I'm going to change my emotions. No. You have to change your perspective, and that can through that you can change your emotions. It's the key to yourself. That's why intellect is so important. So, in these first two paragraphs, what we've seen is that the human soul reflects the divine reality. In the Kabbalistic works, it goes into great length about the three intellectual faculties, the seven emotional faculties in the divine realm. In Hasidic philosophy, in Tanya, it speaks about how these are translated into our personality. That we are in God's image, we have three intellectual faculties, seven emotional faculties. The intellect are the mothers that give birth to the emotions, that direct our emotions. You have the power of love inside you. But what are you going to love? Where are you going to direct that love? Your mind is going to decide. What's good, I love. So what do you define as good? That's where your love is pointed to. You have the power of fear inside of you. Something to stay away from. It's an important emotion. You need to know what to stay away from. You have it inside you. A baby has fear. A baby has love. But the mind will decide, where do you use that fear? What do you run away from? If your mind has things straight, you'll run away from the right things. Things that are indeed dangerous and bad and negative and you should be away from. If the mind hasn't got it straight, so then you might do the wrong way around. Your love may be chasing after things that are really not good for you. And your fear, running away from things that you should be embracing. Your head's got to get it straight. Yeah?
Would you say, like, somebody who's got anxiety or panic, would you say they're responding with the emotional attributes, not intellectual attributes?
Yes. I mean, obviously, anxiety, it's a very broad, you know, spectrum, but as we've discussed previously as well, I would say, yeah, that certainly through calming the mind, that could be worked on and that could be helped. That there's like, it's like things going straight to emotion and not processing fully through the intellect. And so that's where we react irrationally and out of proportion to things. And that can be very hard because once emotions take over, it's very hard to go back into an intellectual space. The definition of emotion is that involvement and that passionate excitement or overstimulation sometimes. It's very hard to move back to a cerebral place where you're objective and reasonable. And so we all need to sometimes slow down that emotional process and go back into a calm view of it, of the reality.
Is Tanya dealing with that, like teaching how to do that, like not to go straight to emotions, but to process it?
Yeah, well, we'll study now the different levels of intellect, and if you have to make sure you go through each one before you get to emotion. There's an idea that Alter Rebbe explains this. In fact, in connection to Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt, which we just experienced, the Pesach, he says that the word Mitzrayim means narrowness. Literally, the word Egypt in Hebrew, Mitzrayim, means narrow, place of narrowness. And in the human body, the narrow point is our neck. If you look at the body, the head has a certain width to it, but we narrow down at the neck and then we widen out again in our shoulders and our torso. And so the Alter Rebbe says that metaphorically, when we were stuck in Egypt, what it meant was in our head we had a connection to God, but it didn't translate to our heart and our body. We couldn't feel it because the narrowness of the neck was blocking. The spiritual state of being in slavery is where you know what's right, but you don't feel it. It doesn't translate into feeling and action. And then Pharaoh, who was not letting the people go, he represents that force within us that doesn't let what we know in our head translate into action. That's why the word Pharaoh in Hebrew, paroi, can be rearranged to be oref, ha-oref, which means the neck, the back of the neck. And so the Exodus from Egypt is opening up the passage between the mind and the heart to allow what we know to come into our emotion. But it has to be done in the correct way. through going through Chachma and Bina and Da'at, which we'll study soon.
We're not stiff-necked. Is that got to that as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stiff-necked people.
Yeah.
Is that you know what's right and you're not acting or you're not learning it.
And then with the reference to like hardening of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Pharaoh.
Yep.
Like block
correct, a blocked heart. Correct. Because Pharaoh himself, he knew. He saw what was happening. Didn't let it affect him. Correct. So yeah, so if we understand Chochmah Bina Da'at, the process, then we understand how to slow down things from going straight to emotion. From making those knee-jerk responses to what's going on. You have to have a Chochmah and then a Bina and a Da'at experience. So let's meet them. Let's meet Chochmah, Bina and Da'at, at least briefly, and understand them. Before we read ahead, it'll be much easier if I explain it. Because once I'll give an introduction, then the words will make much more sense. The intellectual experience, any experience of the mind, is that there's some information that is currently outside of me that I want to come inside of me. Meaning, there's an idea that I don't yet understand or I don't yet have this idea and I want to get it. Either because I'm listening to you, you're talking, you're giving me some information, I want to understand it, so I need to listen and hear and it has to become a part of my mind. You may know what you're talking about, I don't know until it reaches my mind. You've got an idea, you've got information. You want to share it with me, you talk, I listen, and it's got to hit my brain. Or I'm reading information, I'm processing the words, but like it's got to hit my brain, I've got to get it, I've got to understand it. Or I'm trying to figure out a problem, I've got this issue, a problem that I need to solve, I'm trying to get an inspiration, an idea, a way out of this. How are we going to fix this problem? So there's information out there, either in your mind or in the book or in the world of ideas out there, wherever it is, and I need to try and get it into my brain. So I'm thinking. There's a point where an idea hits my brain. Like in the comic books, those light bulbs that go off on top of people's heads. A light bulb moment. Oh, I've got an idea. Or I get it. I know what you're talking about. It's a light bulb moment. It's a flash of insight. What's happened at that second, nanosecond, is the idea has made contact. It's landed in my head. But it's landed in one instant as a flash, as a generality, a big picture. It's there. It's there, but it's not really there, because if you would ask me to explain it at that second, I don't get it yet. It's hit, but I don't get it yet. I still need to absorb the idea. I need to put it into words. I haven't got any words yet. It's like I've got a picture, a flash of a picture, but I haven't got the words yet. I need to work on getting words. So imagine we're at some meeting together. And we're trying to work out a big problem that we've got. We've got an issue with this and with that. And here are all the various moving parts and things that we need to solve. And we're having a brainstorm session. And people are throwing out ideas. Yeah, no, yeah. And someone, oh, I've got it. That oh moment.
Aha moment.
Aha moment. If we would freeze right there. You've got it, but you haven't got it yet. Something hit you, but you need to explain it to yourself before you can explain it to somebody else. So if when I have the aha, you say, what? I have to go, I can't even tell you, wait, because I've got to capture that idea. I've got to get it. It's got to fully sink in before I can even talk about it. I haven't got words for myself yet, let alone to be able to explain it to you. Only when I let it land and I start to put it into a description of words, then have I really got the idea. I could even lose it. Sometimes you go, ah, and then, no, it's gone. because it's not really mine yet. The first step, that aha moment, the flash, is called chachma. It's translated as wisdom, but a better word will be a conceptualization of something. You've conceived an idea. The same as when you're reading or listening, you have these sparks. That's an exaggerated example of the meeting. It's happening every second, even as I'm talking now, that it's landing in your head. Get it? But then for you to really get it, you have to sort of take it in your mind and put it in your words and assimilate it deeper. And that second stage of putting it into your words, developing ideas, called Bina. Understanding. But it really means like taking in the idea, extrapolating it, pulling it out, unpacking it. You know the feeling sometimes you go to a class like this or a lecture or something, and you go, and somebody asks you afterwards, who wasn't there, how was it? It was great. What was it about? Not sure. But it was really good. It was fascinating. It was really interesting. Yeah, but what was it about? Stuff, things, good. Yeah. So what do you mean it was good? Were you there or you're not there? You're there, but sometimes what happens is when we listen to ideas, we have the chachma as we're listening, without so much bina. We have the flash of the idea. Oh, it's a great, that was interesting, that's fascinating, like boom, boom, boom. But we don't assimilate it, we don't allow it to sink in, either because there wasn't time, too. Sometimes, you know, a lecture has so many ideas, boom, 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 that you can't keep up. So they're all amazing. When they hit your head, it was like, whoo. But you didn't have time to break it down and to make it yours. And so you can't repeat it because it came in one ear, out the other sometimes. Because that's chachma without too much bina. It says that when if you look at the Torah, the way the Torah is written is that there's words, 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 and then there's little gaps. And words and gaps, and then there's paragraphs. So it says that that is because when God told Moses the Torah, he paused in between things to let it sink in. You can't just give information. It has to sink in. Oh, you know that feeling where you read something interesting, you've got to stop. I've got to think about that. It's a bit out of fashion, the Bina side of things, because we're so overloaded with information, with headlines, and, you know, to actually stop and think, we've got to do all that much. We've got to keep moving. And in a way, the Chachma is more enjoyable than Bina. Chachma is the pleasure of a new idea, of a new thought, of a flash of inspiration. Whereas Bina is the hard work of putting it into your words, defining it, clarifying it, checking how what are the parameters of this idea. Sometimes an idea seemed good at the time, and then when you flesh it out, it's not such a good idea. Or it's a good idea, but not for here. It doesn't apply to here. Because the flash is good, but then the fleshing it out doesn't work. In a good team, you'll have chachma type of people and bina type of people. Ideas people, creative, like ideas people, and then the practical types who will take the idea and say, well, does it apply or not? Is this going to work or it's not going to work? And each one of us probably tends a bit this way, a bit that way. You know, we have both. But either you're the type that comes up with new ideas, but you might not be such a practical person, or you're not so original in your thinking, but you know how to make a plan. You know how to apply the ideas well. Most of us tend one way or the other. Some are good at both.
What level? Chochmah or
Bina does
like the word epiphany fit into?
The epiphany.
An epiphany.
Epiphany is a chachma moment.
But it's also got a deeper level of understanding to it.
Well, I guess Chochmah can be understanding information that already exists. Like every time we're having any conversation, there's some Chochmah happening. It's a less dramatic Chochmah. An epiphany is a big Chochmah moment where, like, I see things differently. I see it clearer now. Like, but that's happening. It's happening in miniature all the time. Anytime you read something new, it's an epiphany, just not so amazing. It might just be a recipe that you're reading, you know. But like, you still got to get. There is an epiphany when, okay, the recipe. This is what it is. It's just not so exciting necessarily. Whereas there's bigger moments of flashing new ideas. And this is all happening in nanoseconds. It's interesting, in the Zohar, in Kabbalah, it says that Chochmah and Bina are described as two lovers that never part. Our Chochmah and Bina are always connecting to each other. When we have a Chochmah moment, straight away the Bina tries to grab onto it. We've got to then work and make sure that it works, that we develop that Chochmah. We could lose it, but they're partners, these Chochmah and Bina, they go together. And in a healthy person, they're always working together on some level.
Can I quote you on that? Two lovers that never part.
Yeah. Quote the Zohar, don't quote me.
I'm just writing the Zohar. I'm Zohar Mossim.
So, if we don't practice Bina, but we only experience Chachma without putting the effort of Bina, so then what ends up happening is we have a bit more of a superficial experience. It's like that feeling of reading the headlines and, oh, whoa, that's what happened, but not reading the article. The headlines gives you this like flash, but when you actually read the article, it's not always so well reflected of what the headline said. Yes, the headline does somehow reflect the article, but there's more details there. But, you know, the article takes 3 minutes to read. The headline takes a second to look at. So the lazy brain goes from headline to headline. In a similar way, we can do that with a lot of information. Hear the coolness of it, the excitement of the idea, without working on that, examining it, exploring it, breaking it down, defining it, putting in your words, making it yours. Then you didn't really fully understand it. And therefore it's not really yours, and therefore you can't repeat it or remember it. It was just like a feeling. So this is true with all ideas. When we study something, we're studying Tanya right now. If this idea that we're reading now, if this is resonating with you, and you're like, this is interesting, this is giving me a different perspective. You know, we just learned this whole thing about intellect and emotion and this whole different way of understanding ourselves. If you leave it as a Chochmah thing, it's like, wow, cool idea, that was interesting. Tomorrow morning might be gone. Whereas if you have a Bina exercise with this, which means to think through, to chew on it, mull over it, think it through, apply it to yourself, think how this works in yourself, observe it happening inside of you, your emotion, your intellect. If you think it through, it becomes so much more real, so much deeper understanding of it, that it becomes your understanding of the world. It's not just something you read in Tanya, but it's now, this is how I understand myself, my intellect and my emotion, the way I work. It's the hard work of Bina that makes an idea much more developed within your mind. It makes it yours much more. Chachmah wasn't yours. You're watching it. Bina is where it becomes much more yours. In some places in Chassidus, it compares Chachmah Bina to vision versus hearing, seeing versus hearing. When you see a picture, you see the whole picture at once. It's like a flash, a vision. Hearing, you have to hear a description of something. If I describe to you a picture, I have to tell you each detail, one by one. Seeing is much more fun than hearing about a picture. Seeing it yourself, it's visual. Hearing about it is a second hand. But seeing is much more of a flash. Hearing about it, hearing all the details, you build a picture. You know, we all lament about the younger generation, that they're on their phones, and you know, it's all about these clips and everything. You know, in our days, we read a book. And what's the difference between watching a clip and reading a book? The same story. You watch it or you read it. What's the difference? Well, the difference is, when you read a book, you have to imagine it. You have to use your brain much more to imagine the scene. You're involved. Seeing it is passive. You're just seeing it. In a way, there's a deeper impression of something that you've seen, but you have a deeper connection to something that you had to use your brain to imagine, think about. So in a similar way, the Chachmah experience is like the idea flashes at you like a vision almost. The Bina is where you have to put into words and work on it yourself. Yeah.
Jumping a bit, but like, would you say like Adhasina comes forward? Like, is that a Chachma moment? Is that like would Chachma be like the closest realm to godliness?
So yeah, it was a moment, and all prophetic experiences, which Mount Sinai was a collective prophetic experience, hearing the word of God, is going above intellect, which Chachma sort of does that. It goes what's beyond me. On a simple level, just like what you're saying comes into my brain. What's in the book comes into my brain. Yeah. On a high level, Chachma is to perceive that which is even beyond the world of intellect, the realm of intellect. Well, that's interesting. It says at Mount Sinai, they saw what was heard and heard what was seen, which means that they transcended the Chachma and the Bina like paradigms. So these are the first two faculties, but there's a third faculty, the faculty of Da'at. And that we're going to have to save for next week, please God, because we need to get the whole picture. If there's three intellectual faculties, if there's Chachma and there's Bina, the conceptualization of it, and then the application of it in our mind, the development of it in our mind, what's the third faculty? We'll see that the third faculty, Da'at, is that which connects the mind to the heart.
Together.
It brings everything together, but it also brings intellect into emotion. It's an intellectual faculty, but it is what's called the key to emotion. The thing that Pharaoh was trying to stop, the narrowness of the neck that Pharaoh wouldn't let from the mind down to the heart, Da'at is the counter power to that. And that's why Pharaoh said, I do not know God. It says, Lo Yadati. I did not know God. He used the word Da'at. Pharaoh was the opposition of Da'at, the opposition of taking from the mind into the heart. Da'at is the third faculty of the mind that opens up the emotions. How that works, we'll see, please God, next week. Yeah.